To part three of three in our series. I wish I had the ability to add an extra week to this, but unfortunately it doesn't look like that's an option for me. So we have what we have, and we'll have to revisit the Kabbalists of Tzfat at a later date. But thank you everybody for participating. Thank you for being here this morning and the other mornings in our series. I included a note in the email when I sent out the materials for this class about our January series with a flyer for that. Very exciting topic, the creativity and chaos of Jewish Provence. It will be, again, a combination of history and philosophy. And the speaker for that will be Rabbi Sammy Bergman, who works with me in my Beit Midrash. He is fantastic. You're going to really enjoy it. Registration is open, so I expect to send out the flyer again with the follow-up email from today, and probably with a general email to the Wednesday morning group at some point this week for people to be able to sign up. I also want to make sure to call your attention to December 27th. We have a major program, a day of Tanakh study, Tanakh Book of Illness and Healing, 13 half-hour classes from 9:30 a.m. until 1 p.m., and then again in the evening from 7 p.m. to 10 p.m., all free of charge. And I'll include that flyer as well with the follow-up from today, I expect. And that should be a lot of fun that day. This is our fourth year in a row of doing this day of Tanakh study. The first time that we're not offering lunch, I think, but it's the way it goes. Sorry, make your own lunch. Bring your own pizza. Okay, so we have a lot to cover. Rabbi Yitzchak Luria is our main topic this morning, and if we have time at the end, maybe we'll talk about Rabbi Moshe Alshich, or we'll go back to Rabbi Caro and the asceticism question. Both of those are possibilities, but honestly, I don't think we're going to get to do anything but Rabbi Luria today. He needs more than an hour. He's going to get an hour. If you look at the sheet, and again, I posted the link for the sheet in the chat, I gave you in source number one on the sheet that link that I gave you the first week as well, which takes you to my past classes that relate to Kabbalah, our introductory series on Kabbalah, the series we did on Kabbalah Mitzvot. There's a lot there. So follow that link and you'll be able to get to all of those. I think all of those. Hope all of those. I don't know. You'll take it. Hopefully it works. But let's get started here. I brought you two quotes in sources two and three on the sheet that testify to the impact of Rabbi Luria. So if you're looking at the sheet, the first one is my translation from a website called Kabbalah La'am. What does Kabbalah La'am mean to you? What would those words mean, those who speak Hebrew?
Popular Kabbalah.
Popular Kabbalah, right. A website about Kabbalah for the masses. And they say the following about Rabbi Luria. At the age of 35, he appeared in Safed, shrouded by mystery and splendor. In the span of just 2.5 years until his sudden death, he changed the face of history, birthing a powerful shift in the wisdom of Kabbalah, a shift which opened it to us, the nation. That's very grand. It's also interesting. In the span of just 2.5 years, he dies young. Quite a few of the major Kabbalists died young. I have no speculation whatsoever on what that's about, but it's fact, historically. Of course, there were also Kabbalists who lived to a ripe old age. I don't know, you'd have to really do a poll of the numbers and, you know, see overall, but certainly the ones who died young stand out to us, and the Ari, more than almost anybody else. If you take a look at source number three, a little bit of a more academic presentation of his impact, and not just on the world of Kabbalah, but beyond, from Professor Lawrence Fine, in his book about Rabbi Luria, Physician of the Soul, Healer of the Cosmos. Isaac Luria is one of the several most extraordinary and influential mystical personalities that the Jewish tradition has ever produced. Luria may be credited with having helped shape the course of Jewish mysticism in decisive and profound ways. Thus, even though Luria, also called the Ari, I'll come back to that, lived in the Galilean city of Safed for less than 3 years, from early 1570 until his death at the age of 38 in August 1572, his name is virtually synonymous with the great renaissance of mystical community that took place there between approximately 1530 and 1590. So he gets credit for a massive shift in Jewish mysticism, which obviously we'll talk about, in a span of a couple of years. During these six decades, meaning the decades when Safed was at its height, Safed spawned an astounding array of impressive religious personalities. And it really is impressive. In the ellipsis there, I skipped the list of names that he brings. Some of them we've talked about actually in this series. Some of them we have not. Among the Kabbalists, however, it was Isaac Luria whose powerful religious imagination and personal charisma served to arouse the most fervent enthusiasm. He's not the granddaddy of them all, because he's later than many of them. He's coming in after Rabbi Caro, for example. Nonetheless, in terms of his impact, he's the one everybody remembers. Not only did Luria's presence dominate the Kabbalistic community in Safed during the relatively brief time that he lived there, but following his death, the impression his personality had made lived on, providing grist for a rich, legendary tradition. There are loads of stories about him, but his impact goes way beyond that time and that place. Another consequential repercussion of Lurianic Kabbalah is associated with the Sabbatean movement in the middle of the 17th century. We talked about this a little bit.
Shabtai Tzvi.
Shabtai Tzvi, you got it. You know, I just realized I didn't start recording on the video, so I'm going to start that now. They forgot to do that. Apologies to those who are just starting on the video now. I forgot to turn it on. In any case, we're in the middle of source number 3. So the Sabbatean movement, the movement of Shabtai Tzvi, the false messiah in the middle of the 17th century, is considered to be directly impacted by Rabbi Luria's Kabbalah. He goes on to say, while there has been much debate about the precise nature of the relationship between Lurianic Kabbalah and Sabbateanism, was it the inspiration for Shabtai Tzvi? Was it something that Shabtai Tzvi used as a tool as part of his rise? That's unclear. There is no question that the writings of Nathan of Gaza, the central propagandist and religious ideologue, it should be, of the Sabbatean movement, were thoroughly suffused with Lurianic teaching of a theosophical and mythological type. That's saying a lot. Theosophical, I mean, what theosophy is? Not the movement theosophy, but the word. There's a movement also. But theosophy is essentially, as I understand it, the knowledge of God, or the study of God.
So, God
right. Correct. So the statement he's making is that the impact of Rabbi Luria goes beyond being the giant and the one best remembered from that era in Tzfat that he talked about before, continues beyond his time in ways that he would not have wanted in terms of the impact of Shabtai Tzvi. And again, we're not clear on exactly how he fueled that movement, but that's a topic for another time. But then Professor Fine continues. A similar observation may be made with respect to the popular pietistic movement known as Hasidim, which swept through Eastern Europe beginning in the 18th century, right? The end of the 18th century sees the rise of the Hasidim, heavily influenced by the Ari, by Rabbi Luria. As with Sabbateanism, the exact relationship between Lurianic Kabbalah and Hasidism continues to be the subject of considerable discussion. But we'll see some of that impact. We're definitely going to have to talk about that. Another way in which Lurianic mysticism exerted influence was in the realm of religious devotion and practice. Here, Lurianic teaching went far beyond limited scholarly circles and appealed to a much wider audience. A great many of the rituals and customs that Isaac Luria innovated, along with earlier Kabbalistic rituals that he adapted and embellished, eventually found their way into Jewish practice in communities in many parts of the Jewish world. So he is impacting everybody. He's impacting the Hasidim. He's impacting the people who are not Hasidim in terms of shaping the way many of them observed mitzvot, and we'll talk more about that. Besides their general diffusion, Lurianic devotional practices also became the central focus for various Kabbalistic fellowships, meaning groups arose to study and develop Kabbalah and mysticism centered around his ideas. And in the ellipsis there, Professor Fine gives you specific examples. These several examples provide some idea of the wide-ranging and diverse ways in which the life of Isaac Luria and his teachings influenced the religious culture of Jewry. So this is a man whose impact is very live today in a whole host of ways, ranging from being a major influence on the rise of the Hasidim to shaping the way people perform various mitzvot. They're influenced by his teachings, to the Siddur that many Jews use today, which can be built around his innovations, which again, we're gonna talk about. So there's a whole lot we need to talk about in terms of understanding his impact. We got a lot to say. Who was he? What were his ideas? And so on. So first of all, Professor Fine in number 3 mentioned that Rabbi Luria is also known as the Ari. So Ari in Hebrew means, everybody's muted.
Lion.
Lion, right. Ari means a lion. So in one sense, it's a reference to the lion and the idea of the power of the lion, the majesty of the lion. The lion is regal. Yes, we know the real power is the lioness. Nonetheless, the lion has a better PR guy. I don't know. Somehow or other, the lion gets credit. So that's part of it. But it is an acronym. The only question is, an acronym for what? That's the problem. Everybody has a different view about this. So I gave you 3 possibilities in source number 4 that I've seen. He is called sometimes Eloki, Rabbi Yitzchak. Eloki means man of God. He's not Eloki, my God. Eloki, a man of God. He is the godly Rabbi Yitzchak. Or Adonenu, Rabbi Yitzchak, our master, Rabbi Yitzchak, or Ashkenazi, Rabbi Yitzchak, because he was known as Rabbi Yitzchak Luria Ashkenazi. Apparently, that's where his family came from at some point. Although he himself is born in Jerusalem.
Rabbi?
Yeah.
Is Ari a reference to Mashiach?
That sounds like Diane, even though your screen says iPad 5.
Sorry, it's Diane.
Yes. Hi, Diane. So is it a reference to Mashiach? It's an interesting question. There are those who argue, I wasn't really going to go into it here, that he considered himself Mashiach ben Yosef. We have an idea which goes back to the Talmud in Sukkah that there are 2 Mashiachs, there are 2 Messiahs. One who comes first, called the Mashiach descendant of Joseph, and then the second one, Mashiach descendant of Judah. And that he actually viewed himself as the former. But I don't know that that would connect necessarily to the Ari title. I don't know. He's also known as the Ari HaKadosh. There are a few figures who get that title of being Kadosh. Kadosh meaning holy. Usually refers to somebody who is holy in terms of being separate from materialism, but not necessarily. The other thing about him that's really interesting is that people feel duty-bound to write his name the Arizal. Like you'll even see it written as one word, Arizal. Zal, of course, yes. As Sarah says, stands for Zichrono Livracha. His memory should be a blessing. But, we give that name, that honorific to figures from all through history. It's rare to see somebody for whom it actually becomes like part of the name so that people can't say Ari without saying Arizal. And I've never found, I've never found an explanation for why it has stuck so much with him. But let's do a little biography. We're not going to do a whole lot of biography, because I want to talk about his teachings and his ideas and why he had such an impact, but we certainly need to know something about him. So, like I said, his family name includes Ashkenazi, Rabbi Isaac Luria Ashkenazi. because their origins were German. But I don't know how far back that was. He himself is born in Jerusalem in the year 1534. Yes, Janine.
I read that his mother was... Sorry, his father was Ashkenazi.
Yes, so... Right. No, it's just a question of how far back was his father Ashkenazi? Was it that his father actually came from Germany, or was it just that was the family line? And that I don't know, but you're right. It's the father's side that is the Ashkenazi side. The mother's side, we'll see in a moment, was indeed Sephardi, because his father passes away very early on. And his mother moves the family to Egypt, where her brother supports them, and that's the indication that she's actually Sephardi. She passes away in the year 1542. So by the age of 8, Rabbi Luria has lost both parents. I don't know the circumstances of the death of either of them. There are also different versions of it in terms of who died when, but by the age of 8, I think that he's lost both. He gets involved in business while living in Egypt. He is a student of Torah, but he's also a businessman involved in trading spices and grain. We actually have a document in his hand in the Cairo Geniza. Right. For those who are not familiar with the Cairo Geniza, just a very, very quick explanation of what this is, because it's one of the most important resources that we have for knowing what we know about Judaism. Geniza, literally burial or storage, is traditionally the name for a place where you store documents that have God's name on them, since you're not allowed to destroy them, you're not allowed to treat them disrespectfully. So classically, synagogues would have a repository, a geniza, and anybody who had what are called shemos, documents with the name of God on them, documents that were holy, and they couldn't keep them, didn't know what to do with them, would put them there, they get buried eventually. That's the geniza. However, there was a synagogue in Cairo that devoted a room to be the geniza. No one ever went in. There were walls with a hole in the wall, and people would just put their document through the hole. And they put things there that included the name of God, but they put other things there, like just personal correspondence ended up in there. All sorts of stuff ended up in there. Shopping lists, so to speak. So those just keep on going until the end of the 19th century, when on the market for antiquities, you start to see ancient Jewish documents, and no one knows where they're coming from. And researchers, including ultimately Solomon Schechter, do a lot of work and find this place in the synagogue in Cairo. There's a great book. There are a lot of books about this, but there's a great book called Sacred Trash, which tells the story. Yes, Rose, you wanted to say?
There were two sisters.
Yes. Right. No, it's true, and there's a lot more. There's a lot more we could say about it, but what I wanted to highlight is that it's filled with documents really starting from 7th, 8th century and running, you know, for almost 1,000 years from then. No, 1,000 years from then. We have a document in Maimonides' hand, like his own manuscript, and we have this document from Rabbi Luria, from the Ari, which is a business document. It's a business document about their about spices. So I think salt is in it. So he's a businessman, but he's also a student of Torah. I'm going to come back to that. But in the year 1570, he goes to Israel, and we'll talk about why. I'm not doing that right now, but he goes to Israel. He is married. He's with his wife. He's with his two sons. First, he goes to Jerusalem, and then he goes to Tzfat. When he goes to Tzfat, he encounters Rabbi Moshe Cordovero. Rabbi Moshe Cordovero was the leading Kabbalist in Tzfat at the time. I have to admit a little bit of bias here when I talk about Rabbi Cordovero, because Rabbi Cordovero was my great-great-great-great-and-so-on grandfather. We know this because there's a book by Rabbi Aryeh Leib Cordovera, who became Rabbi Aryeh Leib Torchiner, in which he writes in the beginning about how he was the rabbi in Torchin, in Poland, in 1648, when the Cossacks came through under Khmelnytsky, and he, like everybody else in the Jewish community, leaves or dies. And he renames the family Torchiner from Torchin. But originally we were Cordovero. So at some point I was Spanish. That's the moral of the story. But in any case, Rabbi Cordovero was, my bias notwithstanding, the lead Kabbalist of the time, the heir to the mainstream Spanish approach to Kabbalah, which had been going for centuries. Rabbi Luria studies under Rabbi Cordovero for 3 months. Rabbi Cordovero passes away after those 3 months. A little bit of Rabbi Cordovero's impact is important in order to understand what existed before Rabbi Luria came along. If you take a look at source number 5, this is from Rabbi Cordovero's Pardes Rimonim. His Pardes Rimonim was an encyclopedia of Kabbalah. It was a rational approach to mysticism. He's source-based. It's philosophical rather than what we usually think of as mystical. There's a lot of logic to it, even though he's dealing with things that don't sound all that logic-based. But take a look at number 5. This is my translation. He says, it is well known regarding the number of sfirot. What are sfirot? Anybody know?
Heavenly emanations.
Heavenly emanations. That's not bad as the translation of sfirot. They are the channels of divine influence to this world. That's an easy, simple translation. It really doesn't do it justice. Nonetheless, he says, regarding the question of how many sfirot there are, all who are involved with this hidden knowledge have agreed as one that there are 10. There are 10 sfirot. There's no debate in this at all. This is one of the matters in which the covenant has been executed, meaning that everybody agrees regarding knowledge of the sfirot. And we have the book of creation, which is ascribed to our patriarch Abraham, and some ascribe it to Rabbi Akiva. That's not decided. The words of this book are so deep, so lofty, and they are hidden from the eyes of the intellect of those who examine it. And even though there are many different explanations, still we require explanation of all of its parts, therefore we will explain its words as much as we can to the extent of our weak intellect. So he says, I'm going to try to explain all this stuff that people don't understand, and that's what he does with his Pardes Rimonim, this heavily Kabbalistic work. At the same time, he also wrote a work called Tomer Devorah, the Palm Tree of Deborah, which is much more accessible than Pardes Rimonim. It's about human beings striving to emulate God. So I brought you my translation of the beginning of Tomer Devorah in source number 6, in which he says, man is suited to resemble his creator. And then he achieves the secret of the higher form, Tselem and Demut. I'm not going into what Tselem and Demut are. If he were to resemble his creator physically, but not in his actions, he would be making the form into a lie. They would say of him, this is a pleasant form, but ugly deeds. In other words, what he's saying is, to be created in the image of God means that we have the ability to emulate God. And if we have that ability to emulate God and we don't make it so, we don't bring that into reality, then we turn our resemblance to God into a fiction, into something deceitful. You have to use your potential to become godlike. That's his message. I mean, there's a lot there, obviously. He emphasizes in this work traits that, in terms of how we relate to others, traits in terms of our relationship with God. It's a beautiful, beautiful work. It's actually available in English translation. I don't think Pardes Rimonim.
It changed my life.
Wow. Okay. Then I'm glad to have that endorsement for it as well. Buy my great-great-great-great-grandfather's book. I don't get royalties. Okay. So, incidentally, also, Rabbi Cordovero has a famous brother-in-law. Rabbi Cordovero's brother-in-law was Rabbi Shlomo Halevi Alkabetz, who wrote the song Lecha Dodi. Right? L'chadodi from the Friday night liturgy is actually not a nice song about Shabbos. It's actually a mystical work about divine influence on this world. People who study the Sfirot can find references to the Sfirot in Lecha Dodi. There's a lot going on there. Both Rabbi Cordovero and Rabbi Alkabetz are building off the earlier schools of Kabbalah. Rabbi Luria is going to take it in a different direction, as we're going to see. Rose, if you ask the book, Tomer Devorah is the Hebrew, Palm Tree of Deborah is usually the way it's rendered in English. The Ari, Rabbi Luria, when he arrives in Tzfat, is part of the general community. He's not isolated. So we actually have a responsum that Rabbi Caro, who we discussed the last 2 weeks, sent to him, addressing a business question. There was a question about an investment partnership and assets were destroyed and who's responsible and replacing the assets. And Rabbi Luria sends him his thoughts on it and asks Rabbi Caro for his opinion. Rabbi Moshe Alshich, whom we may discuss later, gave sermons on Shabbat, and Rabbi Luria used to go to those sermons. So he's not like off in a castle somewhere. But when Rabbi Cordovero passes away, Rabbi Luria becomes the dominant teacher of Kabbalah in Tzfat. He does not publish on his own. We're going to come back to that in a bit. But his students publish his work, and mainly Rabbi Chaim Vital publishes his work. Other sages try to join his school. Some of them he accepts. Some of them he sends away and says, this is not for you. Rabbi Alshich is one of those he says, this isn't for you. The Ari dies just 2 years later in an epidemic in Tzfat. So how did he become a mystic? He began his education in Egypt with traditional Torah education. He studied under Rabbi David Ibn Abi Zimra, also known as Radbaz. He excelled in mainstream Torah study. I brought you something interesting in source number 7 along those lines. There's a major work on the Talmud from this era. It's called Shita Mekubetzet. You don't need to know that. That won't be on the exam. But it's called Shita Mekubetzet. It's a commentary or collection of commentaries really on the Talmud. And it was written by Rabbi Bezalel Ashkenazi, who apparently was in Egypt at this time. And if you take a look at source number 7, Rabbi Chaim Yosef David Azulai, worthy of his own class, honestly, wrote a work called Shem HaGedolim with biographies of great figures, and he mentioned the following in source number 7. In his youth, he's talking about Rabbi Luria, he recorded a Shita Mekubetzet, on Tractate Zvachim, an esoteric part of the Talmud, in the compilation of his mentor, Rabbi Bezalel. And through our great sins, it was burned in the fire in Izmir with all of his books. We don't have it. This would have been a non-mystical work of Rabbi Luria, a work on the Talmud. So he excels in traditional Torah knowledge. However, his mentor, Rabbi David Ibn Abi Zimra, Radbaz, was also a Kabbalist. And it could be he started to study Kabbalah from him. But as the legend of the Ari goes, one day he encounters some random person who has a copy of the Zohar. This is in Egypt still. The one version of the story is that it was a Jew who had been forced to live as a Christian in Europe until fleeing to the Ottoman Empire. We don't know. But he gets a copy of the Zohar from this fellow, and he starts to study it intensely. Early biographies of him talk about him leaving his home and devoting himself entirely to this study for 6 or 7 years, coming home during that time only for Shabbat. So he shows up Friday afternoon with the family for Shabbat, and then he leaves to go back to this little hut that he's living in by a river where he's studying the Zohar. After this period of time, 6 years in some sources, 7 years in other sources, a voice says to him he must go to Israel immediately to teach somebody in Tzfat named Chaim. And that, of course, becomes Rabbi Chaim Vital, his lead student. Noteworthy, at this point in time, the Zohar is on the rise in general in the Jewish world. Part of that is the messianism we've talked about. A part of that, believe it or not, is from the Catholic Church. What do you mean? Well, Pope Julius III burned the Talmud in Italy in 1553. Public burning of the Talmud, like if you're familiar with the one in France that had occurred a couple of centuries earlier, happens in Italy in 1553 because the Pope says it opposes, the Talmud opposes Christianity. But then he reads the Zohar and he says, oh, that can support Christianity. There's stuff in there that seems to ascribe multiple aspects to God, ideas that Kabbalah is trying to present in a Jewish framework, but he says this could support Christianity. Let's print the Zohar. And so in 1559, the church publishes the Zohar, popularizing its study. So the Ari's Torah, Rabbi Luria's Torah, starts from that point where he is studying the Zohar while he is in Egypt. And then it grows when he comes to Tzfat. One more point, which I already alluded to, but now I'll show you a source for it, is that he didn't write. We have a couple of random things that he wrote. We have three Aramaic songs that people sing on Shabbat from him. If people are familiar at all with the songs Askinu Si'udasa, or Atkinu Si'udata, those are his. Those are Rabbi Luria's. But overall, he didn't write. If you take a look at back in source number 7 from Rabbi Azulai, the second half of source number 7, he says, it is already known that his students, Rabbi Luria's students, asked why he did not compose books of his great Kabbalistic knowledge. He replied that he couldn't, for wellsprings of knowledge would suddenly open for him and he lacked the strength to write it. Even speaking was difficult, to find a narrow channel with which to speak to them. He had so much just flowing out of him, he said, I can't do it. And so his students, and primarily Rabbi Chaim Vital, are the ones who write down his teachings. I realize I'm rushing here through a lot of information. I'm going to pause for a moment here. Questions and comments before we go further? We're good? Yes, Janine. Okay, we're getting there. Yeah, no, that's going to take time, but we're getting there. So what I want to do, I'll just map out where we're going, is to talk about his ideas. What was his mysticism? What were the key ideas? Why was it so popular? And then to show its influence in particular on the Siddur and how people pray today, that's going to take us into how the Hasidim end up getting his Siddur. That's part of our discussion. And then I want to talk about the Kabbalah Center and other popularizations of his Kabbalah and why they exist. So that's where I want to go with this. So his Kabbalah, sorry, I stopped before making sure that there were any other questions or comments before we go further. Okay. So his Kabbalah was a departure from that of his predecessors, although he grounded it in the Zohar and in Jewish tradition, meaning he's not making it up out of whole cloth. The philosophy was one of what we call tikkun. What does tikkun mean? Sorry?
Correction.
Correction, fixing, repairing, improvement. The idea is that with our actions, we redeem spiritual sparks. We effectively are generating things that are positive. We are generating spirituality instead of a top-down approach in which spirituality comes to us from the heavens, although that's there in his philosophy. We are generating something spiritual with our deeds. And through this, he provides an explanation of the world that is extremely appealing. First of all, if you're assuming that you need to engage in tikkun, repair, fixing, improving, what does that say about the state of the world?
It needs fixing.
It needs fixing, precisely. as Diane said, it needs fixing. He's validating our sense of the world, right? He's validating our sense that this world is a place that is broken. By telling you that, there's something for us to fix. He also puts the tools in our hands to repair the world, saying that our deeds, our mitzvot, our prayers, and so on, are not only about our spiritual existence, but they're about repairing the world. And it does it with authenticity, by anchoring its message in classic Torah, as well as in the Zohar. So it's not just somebody coming along and popularizing an idea. It's somebody who is saying, this has been here all along, even if others did not interpret it that way and didn't come out with this message. In order to get a better sense of how this works, we're going to need to define some terms, which I listed for you in source number 8. He builds on an idea which existed before Rabbi Luria, but he really develops it, called Tzimtzum. Anybody know what Tzimtzum means?
Contract.
To contract.
Minimalizing contraction.
Right. Contracting is a really good translation for it. The root, the Tzadi Mem, or Tzadi Mem Mem, that it comes from, is a term that is used for things that shrivel up, that dry up. A junction in Israel on the road is called what?
Somet,
exactly. Same thing. A joint on the body, like the knee, is also called a tzomet. The tzamei, someone that is thirsty, you know, because that which is lacking water, which dehydrates, shrivels up. Also, same thing, tzamei. So the...
Okay.
Sorry?
Raisins,
tzimukim, excellent. Thank you. I didn't see who said that, but that's correct. Okay, thank you, Dan. So the idea of tzimtzum is this kind of contracting. How does that apply here? So I translated a piece of Eitz HaChaim, which is a principal work of Rabbi Chaim Vital, explaining Rabbi Luria's Kabbalistic ideas in source number 9. He says, "No, you should know that before the recipients received and the creations were created, there was higher light, simple, which filled all existence, and no space was empty. All was filled with that simple, infinite light. There was neither beginning nor end, but all was the simple light, all equal with total equality." This is what is called the infinite light. That's the state of everything pre-universe. "And when it arose in his simple will," when he uses the word simple, I should explain, I'm using the word simple to translate the word pashut in Hebrew. It means undifferentiated. There aren't different ideas, there aren't conflicts, it's just this. I can't come up with a better word for it in English than simple, but simple has many different meanings, so that gets complicated. Nonetheless, "when it arose in his simple will," his being God's will, "to create the worlds, and to give to the recipients," that will be us, "to bring to light the completeness of his deeds and his names and his kinuyim." Kinuyim are descriptions of God, "which was the cause for creation of the world," as is explained to us. When God decided, "I want to bring to light all of this, I want to give to creations," and that's why he created us, then he restricted himself to a center point within him. That's the word tzimtzem. He restricted or constricted, I think, is actually a better term. So I thank those who gave that idea. He constricted himself to a center point within him, in the actual center. And he restricted that light. And it was distanced to the sides all around that center point. What remained was an open space and air, an empty space from that actual center point. If you don't understand that, you're in good shape. That we're not supposed to understand it, certainly from a very fast read. But the core idea of Tzimtzum here is that that God decides to make room for creation by restricting the place where he is. That's the idea. Now,
how do you say infinite light in Hebrew? What's the Hebrew for that?
Or Ein Sof.
Oh,
that's the Ein Sof. Okay. Yeah, Ein Sof, literally, infinite. So Malka asks a question in the chat. So what about Breishit, where we're told the world was choshech, was darkness, and tohu vavohu? Tohu vavohu is a very hard thing to translate. I'm not even going to try. But the simple and straightforward answer is he deals with it. And you'd have to read Eitz HaChayim to see it. He has a ton here. I wanted to translate more. And every time I tried to translate it, I found that my English was actually less clear than his Hebrew, which is saying something. This is the sort of thing you really need to study in order to grasp it, and even then, I wish you luck. But the answer is that he does show how this fits and how this is actually seen in Bereishit. But one thing that already becomes clear with this little bit that we've just read is that there are real issues with what he's teaching, in the sense that if God is infinite, by definition, God cannot constrict where he is. Because anything that isn't in a particular place is automatically limited. So this is why Kabbalah traditionally is only studied by people who, number one, are well anchored in knowledge of basic Torah, and number two, by people who have reached a degree of stability in their lives, a certain age, a certain family situation, such that they're not going to read this and think, oh, everything I've learned about Judaism is wrong. Let me go off and create a new religion. That's the theory in studying mysticism, is you have to first know the basics and be versed in that and be at a stable point in life before you're going to start looking at this, because I could read this and come away with the idea then that God is not infinite, which in Judaism tends to be a problem. So this is the idea of tzimtzum, the idea that God withdraws. The next term I gave you in source number 8 is a term we've already referred to called sfirot. This is a very big idea long before Rabbi Luria comes along. Scholars actually connected in some sense with Greek ideas. Sfirot are supposed to be the channels through which the light of God reaches this world. I saw somebody's eyes go wide when I mentioned the connection to Greek ideas. There is a school of thought that suggests that this was Kabbalistic and that Plato learned it from the Greeks. They've learned it from Kabbalah, I should say. How that worked, who pioneered it, who had it first, none of it is anything that I am at all qualified to speak about. But the idea is that there are channels through which the light of God reaches this world, because God is entirely pure and spiritual, and this world is material and physical. And how can it be that the spiritual leads to the physical? They're entirely different dimensions. And so there's this idea of channels through which the light ultimately reaches a material state and a material realm. But what Rabbi Luria pioneers, I mean, he develops the idea of tzimtzum, but what he really pioneers is the next thing in source number 8, which is shivirat hakelim. My Hebrew speakers, what does shivirat hakelim mean?
Breaking
of the vessels, correct. And this is the idea that, this is the idea that when God creates light that he sends to this material realm is not able to support it. The kelim, the receptacles that are supposed to receive that light, are not able to sustain it, and the result is that they break. And that scatters the light. And the light is embedded in what are called klipot. Klipot are shells. Usually they're translated that way. And the mission that we then have is to return those sparks of light to their source, to restore the originally intended state, which will perfect our world. And that's the process of tikkun. And the sparks are called nitzotzot. Nitzotz is a spark, like regular sparks. So it's used here as well. Are we clear? Nurit, you had a question?
No, but I just had a floating
Yeah.
That when God did the tzimtzum of the world, because then he created man in the material world to separate the spirituality, his spirituality from the world.
Mm.
That's what the tzimtzum is.
Interesting. So there's an awful lot to unpack in this. We're not going to be, if you want, you can go back to the introduction on Kabbalah series that I gave where I discussed some things that relate to this. But yeah, you're going beyond where I'm going to be able to have time for in this session. We already are down to 13 minutes and I've got a lot to go. So I'm going to take Mark's question and then I'm going to go further.
When you talk about having the proper maturity to delve into this, is there anything analogous to the story a couple of thousand years earlier going to the
Pardes? Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. That's the idea. The story that Mark refers to is a passage in the Talmud in Chagiga, which speaks about four sages going into an orchard. And it's clearly not an orchard. When you read the story, you understand that very, very clearly. And coming away with, you know, one of them comes out heretical, one of them loses his sanity. Yeah, no, that's actually very much linked to this. So, how is it? What is our mission here? You know, how do we carry out this mission, I should say? So in particular, it's done with our intentions and our thoughts, and in particular via prayer, so that the Ari, Rabbi Luria, pioneers the idea of kavanot, the idea of particular intentions while you perform an action that elevate the practitioner into a higher realm. He talks about yichudim. If anyone has noticed in a sidur, the phrase l'shem yichud, l'shem yichud kud shabrichu, that's for the unification of God's name, that's from the Ari. Someone asked me to explain nitzotzot again. Nitzotzot are sparks. Those are those sparks of light. Okay, and that's interesting about the boat being called tzimtzum. That's a very interesting thing. Thank you. So this extends, really, what we saw with Rabbi Caro. Meaning Rabbi Caro already was a blend of Jewish law on the one hand and mysticism on the other. And what we see here is Rabbi Luria saying, when you practice Jewish law, when you fulfill mitzvot, when you do the things that God told you to do, you are actually redeeming sparks in this mystical realm. So it's a further blending of the two sides. And what we've said so far is going to enable us to appreciate one of Rabbi Luria's major impacts, which is the Sidur. Today, we have a few major editions of the traditional Sidur. You have Ashkenaz, which includes the classic Ashkenazi communities with some differences between those who came from Western Ashkenaz, right? From Germany, obviously. Then you have those from Eastern Ashkenaz, right? From the Poland area. And then you also have the Italians, who are kind of mavericks. The Ashkenaz started with people who came from Italy to Germany, but the Italians had their own thing going, which is really an interesting discussion for another time. Then you have Sfard. And Sfard, when I say Sfard, I mean communities that came from the Iberian Peninsula, Spain, Portugal, and spread out when they were expelled from there. You also have additions that are related to Sfard, Edot HaMizrach, those who come from the communities around the Mediterranean. The Yemenites have their own thing. And then you have this thing called Nusach Ari, the Ari's edition. Which group of Jews today prays using Nusach Ari? Who does that?
Chabad, Chassidim.
Exactly, Chassidim in general. It's not just Chabad, although there are different versions among different Hasidic groups. So that's really odd. When you think about it, it's odd for two reasons. First of all, and this was Jeanette's question half an hour ago, the Ari, or Janine's question, sorry, the Ari lived in Israel in the 16th century? How is it that Polish and Hungarian Jews in the end of the 18th century and in the 19th century adopt his version of the Siddur? Second, there's another name used for Nusach Ari. It's also called Nusach Sfard, the Sfard edition. How does that make any sense for Poles and Hungarians? So Professor Meir Maidan from the Academy of the Hebrew Language gave a good summary of this in an article in 1960 called Tfilot HaChasidim, and I've translated a chunk of it here in source number 10, but in the interest of time, I'm going to say it outside, and you can read it in the text as well. He said, the Ari, Rabbi Luria, emphasized the importance of prayer as a means of perfecting the world. He argued that every aspect of prayer, including the wording, even the number of words in a prayer, actually matters. So, for example, people who say Kiddush Friday night using the Ari's version take out certain words that appear in the standard Ashkenazi version because they want to have 35 words in that paragraph. Why 35? Great discussion. Not for right now. For those who can stay later, I'll explain. But everything about the text matters. So the Ari, Rabbi Luria, took the existing Sephardic Siddur that was found in his day in Egypt, in Israel, in that region, and he amended it, creating something that we call Nusach Sfarad. It is Sephardic in the sense that it's from that region, which was influenced by the Sephardim. But Rabbi Luria did not spread this. Rabbi Luria argued there are 12 tribes of Israel. Each tribe had its own channel for praying to God, and you stick with your channel to pray to God. He called them sha'arim, gates. And he said only those who are spiritually attuned can really know which edition of prayer is for them. So stick with what you have, unless you are in this high spiritual level and you can figure out which edition you're supposed to pray with to God. There were those after his time who adopted his text. Rabbi Yaakov Emdin was one of them. There were communities in Israel which adopted his Siddur, which adopted his text for prayer. And then along came the Baal Shem Tov. The Baal Shem Tov was the founder of Hasidism in Poland towards the end of the 18th century. He claimed that this process of tikkun, of repairing the universe, is for everybody, and its mysticism should be for everybody. And so he took the ideas of Rabbi Luria and popularized them. And Hasidic groups adopted all or part of the Ari's text for the Siddur. So it was Nusach Sfard to them, because it came from Sfard to them, to Poles, to Hungarians. They look at this and say, oh, this looks Sfard. So they call it Nusach Sfard, the Sfard edition. And that's why there are many similarities between what Hasidim do and what Sfardim do. Example, I grew up in an Ashkenazi community. When Kaddish is said, it starts, Yizgadav Yizgadash Shmei Rabbah, that's in an Ashkenazi community. Sfardim and Hasidim both throw in the words V'yatzmach purkanei v'karev mishichei. How is it that Hasidim in Poland and Hungary are doing what Sfardim are doing in Syria and Morocco? Why do they have the same tradition? The answer is thanks to the Ari. Because the Ari includes it in his Siddur, and the Baal Shem Tov, founder of Hasidism, popularizes what the Ari did among the Hasidim. There's a lot more in the Siddur that's joint between the two. But that's how the ideas of Rabbi Luria end up becoming very popular among Hasidim. A lot of Hasidic thought is built on Lurianic Kabbalah. You follow? Okay. Now, a word about other popularizations of Kabbalah. We've already noted that there's a lot of appeal in a philosophy like Rabbi Luria's that validates our negative feelings about the world and at the same time promises optimism and empowers us to change that world. So at first glance, you might ask, what's the difference between what the Hasidim did, popularizing Rabbi Luria's Kabbalah, and, let's say, the Kabbalah Center, right? Philip Berg's work, for those who are not familiar, each one of them popularized Kabbalistic ideas. So the difference between them, I think, is very important. Hasidim maintained what Rabbi Karo taught and what the Ari taught, that mitzvot are the way to reach God. And Kabbalistic practices occur in that context. I thank Malka for putting a note in the chat which anticipated where I was going with this. The misnagdim. What does the word misnagdim mean?
Opponents.
Opposition. This was a brilliant branding move. Right? If you want to be really smart about branding a new movement, what you do is you cast those who disagree with you as the opposition. Even though they were the mainstream. The Hasidim are the opposition. But they called everybody who wasn't Hasidic the opposition. So everybody else ended up being called the opponents, which makes no sense whatsoever. They're not the opponents. They were the mainstream. Nonetheless, that's not my main point. The main point here, what I'm trying to get across, is that those who rejected Hasidism argued that the Hasidim were dropping elements of ritual. We're de-emphasizing elements of ritual as part of popularizing Kabbalah and popularizing mysticism. So they argued that this attempt to say everybody can repair the world, everybody can engage in tikkun, you don't have to be a scholar and all of that, Misnagdim thought that was a threat. Hasidim also tended to de-emphasize things like prayer at a particular time, saying it's more important to pray with great concentration than to pray at the right moment. And the Misnagdim looked at that and said, you know, you're going to end up eating matzah in the sukkah because you're waiting for it to have the proper intentions when you eat your matzah. You're going to forget Passover and just do it months later. That was the argument. So there was a lot of back and forth about this. As the early Hasidim evolved, the fears diminished because they stopped being as radical as they were originally. And you start to see that really it's based in Jewish practice. What you see happen with the Kabbalah Center is that it separates the mysticism from the mitzvah practices. Take a look at source number 11, an article from the New York Times from 2003. Jewish mysticism surges on a tide of red strings. The connection between pop culture, Kabbalah, and the real thing, quote, is the relationship between pornography and love, said Adin Steinsaltz, a Hasidic rabbi in Jerusalem, he passed away a few months ago, who has written several books about Jewish mysticism, including the newly published Opening the Tanya, .. I mean, he wrote on everything. Rabbi Steinsaltz really deserves a session of his own. But he goes on to explain, pornography is intrinsically soulless and doesn't have any obligations attached, Rabbi Steinsaltz said. It's just using externals. They're doing exactly the same thing. They're taking the mysticism and removing the sense of responsibility and covenant from it. Goes on, most of the traditionalists' fury is directed at the Kabbalah Center International, a religious nonprofit organization run by Rabbi Philip Berg of Los Angeles. He was in Toronto at one point. His wife Karen and his sons. They have 10 locations in the U.S., 13 in other countries like Israel and Chile.
I thought he was from New York.
It could be he was originally, but he was in Toronto at one point. I can tell you how I know about that later, once the recording is off. I want to get through this because it's already 11. The Kabbalah Center markets Jewish mysticism to everyone, Gentile and Jew, adults and children, as a system of tools for self-understanding to be acquired through its courses, books, tapes, and gear like t-shirts and key rings. They didn't mention Kabbalah water. That's part of it. But scholars of Jewish mysticism say the center divorces Kabbalah from the obligations or mitzvot of traditional Judaism. And here you get Rabbi Shochet from Toronto saying what they teach is heresy. Rabbi Shochet then went on to quote one of Kabbalah's architects, Rabbi Isaac Luria, who was born in Jerusalem in 1534, and believed that each commandment has a mystical meaning. Just as the body cannot live without the soul cannot function without the body. And that's what he goes on to say. And then you get the defense by Rabbi Yehuda Berg of the Kabbalah Center.
There was litigation with Rabbi Shoyachin.
Okay. The point that I'm trying to make and what I want to stress here is the connection between Rabbi Caro and Rabbi Luria and the mysticism Rabbi Luria teaches. Even though Rabbi Caro is old school, he's from the Spanish schools. He's not of Rabbi Luria's school. What they share, what they have in common, is the idea that Jewish law and Jewish mysticism are intimately connected. And what Rabbi Luria, what we see in Rabbi Caro, author of the Code of Jewish Law on the one hand, and talking to an angelic embodiment of the Mishnah every night on the other hand, is seen in Rabbi Luria, where he says, when a person lights Shabbat candles, when a person eats kosher, when a person prays, if their focus intellectually is on God and redeeming the sparks, that becomes a mystical act. That's what you're seeing in his teaching. Now, I gave you review questions on the sheet, which I want to go through quickly because of, we had to go through this whole topic very quickly. On the sheet, I also gave you some sources on asceticism. It'll have to be a discussion for another time. But I am going to stay on after the review questions to continue the conversation. So anybody who wants to discuss more should please do so. But those who need to go, you only signed up till 11, so you don't need to feel any guilt. So the questions here. Who was the leading Kabbalist in Tzfat before Rabbi Luria arrived? So that was Rabbi Moshe Cordovero, author of those books that we referenced earlier. How was Rabbi Luria's Torah published? So that was by the students who recorded it, particularly Rabbi Chaim Vital. What marked Rabbi Luria's Kabbalah as a departure from that of his predecessors? His philosophy of tikkun, in which we redeem spiritual sparks and effectively are perfecting the world ourselves, as opposed to just living in a world to which spirituality comes from above. Tzimtzum is the idea that God withdraws to make room for creation via his light. Contracts, withdraws, restricts, however you want to say that. Why is there a need for us to redeem sparks of light? And the answer is because the light that God sent could not be contained by the receptacles to which it was sent, and they broke. Does that mean God knew this was going to happen, didn't know this was going to happen? That's a really good question for the mystics. So we need to redeem those sparks of light, which we do via prayers and meditations and mitzvot. How did Rabbi Luria's edition of the Sidur become popular? The Baal Shem Tov spread it among the Hasidim, and that's how it became so widespread. And the Kabbalah Center was denounced as an abuse of Kabbalah because it dropped that whole focus on mitzvot. It kept meditation, it kept self-examination, but it dropped all of these practical applications. Someone sent me a question in the chat, and with this I'm going to open the Q&A part. And again, those who have to leave totally understand. So someone sent me a question. When was the Zohar written? How does it fit with Kabbalah and mysticism? So I'll give you a little bit now, but I'll also refer you to source number one on the sheet, where I gave you a link to the introductory classes on Kabbalah that I taught, because we discussed it more there. The Zohar is attributed to Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, who was a sage from the time of the Mishnah in the first century Common Era. The Romans drive him into a cave. Well, the Romans threaten his life. He goes to hide in a cave where he and his son, Rabbi Elazar, live. They study for 12 years. They end up adding on a 13th year. Long story. But in that cave, they perfect themselves to a high spiritual level, so much so that when they come out, they can't deal with the physicality of this world. They look at things and things burn. The Zohar is attributed to them. Whether that means the entire Zohar or a core part of the Zohar is debated. There are those who argue that none of the Zohar was actually written by him, but it seems like part of it was, and part of it came from later sages. The Zohar is not published at that point, which is not surprising, because in general, Jewish mysticism at that point is by and large not published. It only emerges at the end of the 13th century by someone by the name of Rabbi Moshe de Leon. He's the one who publishes it, claiming that he has this manuscript that's been passed down teacher to student. You may remember that we said that the Spanish schools of Kabbalah erupt in the 13th century. That's when others are developing and popularizing this mysticism. So there are those historically who argued that the Zohar was not Rabbi Caro, Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai's, it was actually Rabbi Moshe de Leon writing it. But we have no way to answer that decisively. If you look it up online, you find different views.
So, can I just ask?
Yeah.
It was me who asked that question.
Yes.
Is it based in Jewish law as well as in mysticism?
So the Zohar includes certain statements that relate to Jewish practices, to mitzvot. There are times where the Zohar is quoted as a source for a debate in Jewish law. There's some debate as to whether it should be used that way or not, but generally speaking, where the Talmud is silent on an issue, or where there's a dispute, then authorities in Jewish law have quoted the Zohar as a legal work, but its primary design is a commentary to the Torah portions, to the Chumash. That's how most of it is structured. It's all written in Aramaic, and it's written with a lot of flowery and technical, philosophical and mystical terms, which make it a very, very hard read. I do recommend going to that link because we did a series last year or the year before on the Kabbalah of Mitzvot. And I talked specifically about Shabbos, for example, from the Zohar's perspective. I think it's worth catching that. There's a question in the chat. If, as we explained, the Kabbalah was transmitted via select group as a mystical tradition and Rabbi Luria originated a new stream, where did that come from? Did Rabbi Luria argue he had some special revelation? That is a fantastic question. Kabbalah, by definition, is supposed to be a tradition. You're not supposed to be able to invent something new. Nonetheless, by Rabbi Luria's time, you already find people like Rabbi Cordovero who are studying Kabbalah in very logical ways, not simply repeating a tradition that's been transmitted, but trying to understand it, trying to systematize it. What Rabbi Luria does is present ideas like this idea of Shvirat HaKelim, right, the breaking of the vessels, which he is able to say, well, actually, people thought the Zohar meant X, but they actually meant why. They meant what I'm teaching now. So he showed how you could read the Zohar and traditional sources as anticipating what he was saying. But it seems like he was really presenting ideas that were his own logical ideas, logically derived, rather than a revelation. He was not claiming, as far as I understand, that these were new revelations. He was claiming that they were rooted in the older revelations. That's my understanding of it. I have to stress, and I've said this, you know, a couple of times in the course of this series, I'm not a Kabbalist. I've learned some things, but I would not consider myself to be a tremendous expert. I can refer you to sources that are good that can help with it, but there are limits to what I grasp here. Other comments and questions? Yes, Marilyn.
So when you say at the beginning, first Zohar was not published, you said that, but was it the 13th century something was. What happened in that time period? How did it get passed on? Was it verbally only, orally, or had something been written?
So it is definitely explained verbally, but it is passed down in some written form, just in secret, is the idea. That's not unique to the Zohar. First of all, we have many mystical books that claim that was how they were transmitted. But even beyond that, going back to the times of the Talmud, there were traditions of writing down things one had learned and not publishing them, but just in a private group, they had access to it. It was called Megillat Starim, literally a scroll of things that are hidden. In some cases, it was done for technical religious reasons because we were not supposed to write down the verbally transmitted Torah until we had to because of what the Romans had done to us, and that became the Mishnah and the Talmud. So some things were not written down for that reason. Some things were not written down because they were considered sacred, and writing them down was inappropriate. There's this very interesting Talmudic teaching that says that people who write down blessings, texts of prayers, are burning Torah. Because on Shabbat, if there's a fire, you're not allowed to save these texts from the fire, and therefore you're consigning them to be burned. It's a very odd statement. Like, how frequently did things burn? How frequently were there fires that this was really such a concern? Nonetheless, there is a clear imperative against writing things and spreading them, in part because of concern for what happens when you publish things, which is people get access to them, including people you don't want to have access. Whether that's the Romans early on, or whether it's the Catholic Church, there are enemies you don't want to have access to things. And in particular, if what you're teaching is a form of mysticism that really challenges Jewish tradition, like you're talking about God being infinite but then constricting himself, you talk about masculine and feminine aspects of God and the like that stuff like that is dangerous, frankly. And so for that reason, it doesn't get spread. The Talmud actually says that you're not allowed to teach certain mystical aspects of the Torah, the story of creation, the chariot of God, or the throne of God that Ezekiel witnesses. You're not allowed to teach it to a group. You can only teach it with a student who is wise enough to understand hints on his own and figure it out. Like, it's something that there was always great concern about in terms of publishing it and where it would go, and therefore they really didn't publish it. Rose?
It is, although it's not mainstream, I know that my Torah teachers taught me that there is an androgynous reading of God, that God is half female, half male. I'm sure you're familiar with that reading. It's not, I don't know, it doesn't seem propagated by the majority of scholars, but it is present.
So, I would say two things. Number one is that we're taught God doesn't have a body. So if God doesn't have a body, the whole male-female thing is already out the window. But the other piece of it is that Judaism has traditionally been very concerned about all attribution of traits to God at all. Because once you describe God as having traits, that narrows God. So Maimonides is famous for, well, he's famous for a lot of things, but one of the things that he's famous for in this realm is for saying you can describe God in three ways. Number one, based on what God is not. So you could say God is not weak. God is not mortal. You can describe God by saying God is the greatest of whatever positive trait you want. So most generous, strongest, wisest, whatever it is, all-knowing. And you can describe God based on God's actions. So I can't say who God is, but I can say what God does.
Okay.
There's a real allergy to that, and that's where you see this whole controversy over saying God is male, female, neither, both, whatever. Yeah, the whole thing is fascinating.
Made in God's image implies the spirituality, the spiritual version of what God is.
So the idea of being made in God's image is a fascinating problem. Rashi, in his commentary to the Torah, retranslates the Hebrew. He says it's not the image of God, like God's image, but rather the image designed by God. God's property, so to speak. That's how he deals with the problem. But it's a bigger discussion for sure. Rabbi Cordovero, in the piece that we saw, says it means that we are able to emulate God's actions.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Sure. Okay, well, thank you very, very much. Feel free to email me afterwards. I know I still owe at least one of you a response to an email you sent me after class last week. But I'm going to get to it, God willing.
Do we have a class next week?
No, we are off. I do want to mention again, though, what I mentioned in the beginning, which is Rabbi Bergman is going to be...